London seems to have dodged disaster as attackers attempted to once again strike the transit system there. Explosions today mimicked the attacks of 2 weeks ago. There were four targets, three on the underground train system and one on a double-decker bus. Police have not revealed much about how the events unfolded, but we do know that there have been no deaths and only one reported injury. At a news conference a few hours ago, Metropolitan Police Commissioner Ian Blair said it's too early to draw a clear connection between today's attack and the bombings 2 weeks ago, but he said the intent was the same.
Clearly, the intention must have been to kill. I mean, you don't do this with any other intention. And I think the important point is that the intention of the terrorists has not been fulfilled.
Joining us now with an update is Nick Fielding, a senior reporter with the Sunday Times of London. And he joins us now by phone from his office in London. It's nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Good afternoon to you.
Are these, do police now think that these were four very small explosions or four bigger explosions that somehow went wrong?
Well, it's being reported as four small explosions, possibly just detonators which exploded. But they're being very guarded about the precise details. I mean, they obviously regard this as a huge golden opportunity. The fact that they have now four partially exploded devices, which may render up a wealth of forensic evidence, and so they don't want to talk too much about the detail because they anticipate possibly making arrests a little bit further down the line.
Have any arrests been announced?
Not yet, no, but I think they're going to be moving fairly quickly on this. I think this is going to move very quickly, this story.
They said, obviously, the possession of these devices gives them a lot of forensic evidence.
Exactly that. I mean, they'll obviously the first thing they want to do is compare these to the previous devices to see whether there's any similarity, and if not, then they'll probably draw other conclusions. But as I say, it's probably a golden opportunity for them.
There were reports of a man with wires emerging from his body going into a hospital. Obviously, if even a detonator exploded and somebody was carrying it, they would have been injured.
That's true, but that report, as far as I know, has been discounted, and it's remarkable both in this today and 2 weeks ago how quickly urban myths are generated, and I think that's probably an example of one of those.
The bombs 2 weeks ago were apparently suicide bombs. Is there any indication of whether today's were intended to be suicide bombs or not?
Well, it's very hard to piece together all the details, but it would appear that in some cases, at least one case that I've seen details about, a bag on somebody's back exploded. In another case, there's a report of somebody dashing onto a train, putting a bag down, and then jumping off immediately. So we have some rather different scenarios, and it points to a rather more amateurish attempt to carry out an attack than the last time round, when clearly all four of the men involved decided that they were going to kill themselves.
Well, thankfully, nowhere near the amount of damage of 2 weeks ago, yet a second attack, this has to have people very worried.
I think it is obviously very, very concerning. I think it's rattled people a little bit. I don't think there's panic by any means, but it's certainly rattled people, and they will be now looking very hopefully for early arrests on this case.
What about London's transport system? What about the subway? Is it open? Is it running?
Bits of it are, but they're going to be very careful because these, as I said before, there's a lot of potentially a lot of forensic evidence to be gathered. Excuse me, and so they're going to be taking their time,
and
make sure they gather as much information as possible.
And bring us up to date on the word on the bombings 2 weeks ago. Your newspaper, or I think it was the Times of London, your sister newspaper, was reporting progress in the investigation on the identification of the so-called fifth man.
Well, that's been a remarkable story because we've had it reported that a man has been arrested, then we've had that denied, then it's been confirmed and denied maybe three or four times, and at the moment it's a little bit of a mystery. I think the latest update, speaking to my colleagues just a few moments ago, is that although a man of the right name has been arrested, it may not be the right person. But it's very confusing at the moment, and we're trying our best to disentangle that information.
All right, Nick Fielding, we appreciate your being with us. You must be very busy. We thank you.
We are indeed, and thank you very much.
Nick Fielding, senior reporter with the Sunday Times of London. He was with us by phone from his office there. Joining us now by phone is Peter Bergen, a fellow at the New American Foundation and author of A Holy War Incorporated, Inside the Secret World of Osama Bin Laden. Thanks very much for being with us, Peter, as always.
Thank you, Neil.
Obviously, it is, the police say, too early to draw a link between explosions 2 weeks ago and explosions today, yet the similarities are extremely striking.
Yeah, no doubt. And as Nick Fielding mentioned, this is sort of a golden opportunity for the police to actually maybe get to the bottom of this one rather quickly, because obviously all the evidence is there, and unlike in the first incident where the evidence, you know, got blown up in the very powerful explosions. There was suggestions that the first, it seems that the operating theory on the first set of explosions is something called TATP, which is a very quite unstable, high explosive, but something that you can make with homemade ingredients if you know what you're doing. It'll be interesting if they quickly identify what exactly is the explosive that was in these bombs that did not detonate.
Of course, the problems could have been with the detonators too, so we don't know.
Yeah.
Yet it seems significant that, all right, September the 11th, devastating attack, but one attack, coordinated, but one attack. Bali, one bomb. Madrid on March 11th, a series of explosions at one train station, one day, one set of bombs. This now looks not like one incident, but maybe a campaign.
It does. And, you know, I grew up in London. I remember, you know, hearing bombs go off. They were IRA bombs, obviously. And, you know, this looks like a sort of jihadist militant campaign with an aim to kill a lot more people ever than the IRA intended to kill. And that's obviously quite worrisome. I think that we're going to see more of this rather than less of it, not just simply in London, but I think all around. You know, the Madrid attack was sort of the beginning of something, not the end of something. And you've got a lot of disaffected young Muslim men who are not integrating, who are disproportionately unemployed, and you know, sometimes they hook up with a radical cleric like Abu Hamza, who's on trial in London, who was the cleric who was the sort of spiritual mentor, I guess, of both Richard Reid, the so-called shoe bomber, and also Zakaria Moussaoui, the so-called 20th hijacker here. And I think one of the keys here is the particular radical clerics. Abu Hamza is now on trial for inciting racial hatred, which is a crime in the United Kingdom. There is another guy that I think people are going to take a very careful look at, Sheikh Omar Bakri Mohammed, who has ties to one of the guys who blew themselves up in Tel Aviv two years ago, a British suicide attacker in Tel Aviv 2 years ago. Also ties to people who had the ammonium nitrate plot. You may remember, Neil, last year in London, half a ton of ammonium nitrate was found in a locker near Heathrow, and it wasn't for gardening. It was, you know, intended for a major attack. And these guys have benefited from, you know, very generous asylum laws that Britain has, also rather generous welfare entitlements in that country. Ironically, the people who are calling for, you know, having the, you know, green flag of Islam flying over 10 Downing Street are also getting welfare benefits. Both Abu Hamza and Sheikh Bakri have drawn on the welfare benefit system. I think the British public, particularly with this second attack, is going to be prepared for some pretty stiff changes in the law. One thing the British government is considering is that it would be a crime to encourage acts of terrorism, which right now it isn't. It is a crime to incite racial hatred. But it is not a crime as yet to encourage acts of terrorism. I think that will change rather quickly.
The British government is also, by convention and treaty, prohibited from deporting anybody to a country where they might face either torture or the death penalty.
Indeed. Actually, that's a huge issue. I mean, that's in the sort of give and take between the United States and our European allies, the fact that we have a death penalty causes quite a lot of problems in cases where people might be extradited to face the death penalty. And that is one of several different things that I think cause a certain amount of tension between our allies and us. I mean, Guantanamo, the treatment of prisoners at Guantanamo is something that European law enforcement authorities are not particularly happy about, the ones that I've talked to. Also, this whole question of renditions, as you may remember, Neil, in Milan, the prosecutor there has actually indicted 13 supposed CIA officers for the rendition of a guy off the Milan streets to Egypt. So there is incredibly good cooperation, I think, generally speaking, but there are certain kind of technical problems, whether the death penalty, whether the renditions, whether the Guantanamo, which can cause problems between our allies and ourselves. And what's interesting about the investigation in London that 2 weeks ago, there is now more of a tie to the United States. One of the people that law enforcement authorities are looking at traveled to the United States, to Oregon, to set up some sort of jihad training camp in the 99 time period. He was allied to Abu Hamza, the radical cleric I mentioned earlier. It's not clear what his role in the plot is yet, but CNN is reporting, for instance, that he is regarded to have facilitated in some manner the plot. You were talking about the fifth man earlier, and Nick Fielding of the Sunday Times indicated you know, how many things have changed in the investigation, misreporting or things that didn't pan out, and that's just the nature of the beast. But they are looking at a fifth man who did travel to the United States, which ties it back to this country, of course.
And that would have been Harun Rashid Azwat?
Indeed. Yes. That is the man that they are looking for. And Harun Rashid turns out to be a rather common name, and there was reports of a Harun Rashid being arrested in Pakistan who turned out to be not the right guy. Harun Rashid Azwat appears to have completely disappeared, and right now his whereabouts are unknown. He lived in England. His family live in the north of England. They have been asked by reporters, have you heard from your son? And they've said, we haven't heard from him for 10 years. So this guy has seemingly disappeared.
We're speaking with Peter Bergen of the New America Foundation about four small explosions earlier today in London at about 12:30 midday local time. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Peter, three of the four suicide bombers identified by police with the first set of explosions were British-born, British-raised, but of Pakistani origin. And many of these leads seem to go back to Pakistan. The president there, Pervez Musharraf, today called for Pakistanis to join him in a jihad against radical madrasas. The madrasas are Muslim schools, some of which are said to preach violence against the West and encourage terrorism. Musharraf has been asked to do this before. He said before he would do it. What's going on?
Well, actually, Musharraf, in a rather ironic statement today, also sort of said the English really need to kind of clean up their act, which is sort of kettle calling the pot black, I think, a little bit. I think Musharraf has personally done a lot in the war on terrorism, and there's been some madrasa reform. There's also been some of the more militant people have been arrested or put under house arrest, or their parties have been banned. But the problem is the Kashmiri militant groups in Pakistan are extremely popular. I mean, the largest group has 2,200 offices around the country. It has an annual gathering where hundreds of thousands of people show up. But, Neil, you may know that I'm somewhat skeptical of the whole madrasa idea in the first place.
Yes.
If you look at serious acts of terrorism, require technical skills and linguistic skills that you just don't get at a madrasa. Now, these guys from who did the London terror attacks were visiting Pakistan, and we know that two of them were there between November 2004 and February 2005, and the other one was there sometime in 2004. My strong hunch is that if they'd gone to a madrasa, they did something else, which is hook up with a Kashmiri militant group like Lashkar-e-Toiba, the very large group I've just mentioned, and also another group called Jaish Mohammed, a much smaller group but a very militant group. And they would have, it's with these groups that they would have learned the skills, you know, how do you set up a cell that won't be penetrated, how do you manufacture these explosives, et cetera. That's not being taught at madrasas. So the real problem is not really the madrasas. I think the larger problem is the revolving door that a lot of these Kashmiri militant leaders have in the Pakistani legal system. They get put under house arrest, and then they get out, and their parties are banned, and then they set up the parties again with a different name. And I can tell you it's a bewildering thicket of names that I won't bore you with now. But these groups have changed their names. Every time they get banned, they kind of morph into something else. And Musharraf, you know, actually can't do a huge amount about it, partly because at the end of the day, Kashmir is a very, you know, it's a very emotional issue for a lot of Pakistanis, and they feel that they, you know, the groups there are. I mean, Musharraf himself, before 9/11, talked about the Kashmir issue as being a jihad. Now, he certainly changed his tune to some degree, but, you know, it's a tough problem. And, you know, if I was a Pakistani official trying to defend the Pakistani government position, I'd say, A, you know, we have legitimate grievance in Kashmir. B, hundreds of our guys have been killed in the fight against al-Qaeda on the border. You know, our president himself has survived two very serious assassination attempts because of his role in cracking down on these groups. And we're doing, you know, how can we do, you keep saying do more, but we're doing as much as we can without, you know, sort of committing hara-kiri as a as a government.
And it must be said that President General Musharraf also faces challenges of his own, not least from a man named Imran Khan, who is not merely a very popular political leader, but sort of the Babe Ruth of Pakistan.
for years. Imran Khan, you know, is a very bright guy, Oxford graduate, one of the world's greatest cricketers. He set up a party with an Islamic flavor. He divorced his British Jewish wife, Jemima Goldsmith, and has gone on to really throw himself into politics. We'll see how successful he is. You know, we've seen sort of people who are celebrities in one area go into politics, and it's been a dreadful failure. Imran Khan, so far, even though he's a very popular guy in Pakistan personally, has only been able, I think, to get one seat in parliament for his party. So it's not a very good showing. In 2007, we will have the elections in Pakistan, which are going to be critical elections for Pakistan, and I think really the world and the United States, because it will be the first time since the military dictatorship that I think that was instituted back in 99, that there are real elections for the presidency. I think that President Musharraf is going to have to allow Nawaz Sharif and Benazir Bhutto, the leaders of the who have been exiled effectively, I think he's going to have to let them participate in some way in these elections if they're going to be really genuine. And I think they're going to have to be genuine, because I don't think the United States or the world community is going to tolerate a situation where the elections are in some way fixed. I think they've got to be open. It's possible that Musharraf himself may run for office in these elections, which would be a good thing. But I think these elections are going to be absolutely critical.
Peter Bergen, thanks as always for being with us today.
Thank you, Neil.
As we mentioned, 4 small explosions in London today. They may have been incomplete explosions. Stay tuned to NPR for continuing developments as they occur. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan.